Well, hey everybody, welcome to MEC. We are in a series on the difference between Christianity and other major world religions. We kicked it off with a look at the difference between Christianity and religions from the East, specifically Hinduism and Buddhism. Last week, we looked at Judaism. Today, we're going to look at what is arguably the most talked about and most controversial religion in the world, the Islamic faith. Few religions have generated the kind of discussions and debates and conversations and dialogues as Islam has. And regardless of world events, it will remain in the news because the Islamic faith is the world's second largest religion, second only to Christianity. There are now almost 2 billion Muslims in the world. The latest Pew Research study found 3.5 million live in the United States alone, and that number is growing very rapidly. It's estimated that by the year 2040, there will be more Muslims in the United States than there are Jews. They will be the second largest religiously affiliated group after Christians in the nation. So let's begin by understanding some things about the Islamic faith. The average Muslim is not who you may think they are, because few faiths have been stereotyped and caricatured more than Islam in the media. The only faith that has been mischaracterized more in the media would be Christianity. For example, you may be surprised to know that the majority of Muslims are not from the Arab world. In fact, the country with the largest population of Muslims is Indonesia. You may also be surprised to know that not every Muslim is a radical terrorist who wants to bomb the world to bits or kill every American in sight. The truth, if you know your history, is that during the Persian Gulf War, Islamic nations such as Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia and others joined with Western nations to fight against Islamic Iraq and its invasion of Kuwait. Many, indeed most, Muslims around the world condemned the terrorist acts on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Most condemned the bombing at the Boston Marathon. They condemned the attacks in Paris. Most Muslims have condemned every other terrorist attack by ISIS or other radicalized groups. So let's get Islamophobia out the door. What is true about the average Muslim is that they are someone who is deeply and sincerely committed to Allah, which is the Arabic word for God. And the primary goal of the typical Muslim is to be submitted to Allah. In fact, that's what the word Islam means, obedience, surrender, or submission to Allah. And the word Muslim simply means someone who is surrendered or submissive. So what is the difference between Islam and the Christian faith? Well, let's dig in, and let's begin with some history. The Islamic faith began with the Prophet Muhammad in the city of Mecca. In the year 610, when Muhammad was 40 years old, he is said to have received his first revelation from the angel Gabriel. This was the first in a series of revelations that were eventually compiled in what we now know as the Quran. At first, Muhammad did not believe that these were really from God. He thought he was possessed by demons. But his wife encouraged him that his visions were of divine origin and that he should teach what he had been shown. So he did. The heart of the message was that there is one God and only one God instead of many gods. Now, the early Muslims were persecuted for that belief and eventually had to flee Mecca to the city of Medina. The Islamic calendar begins when Muhammad himself had to flee Mecca in the year 622. Muhammad and his followers quickly established themselves in Medina, and Muhammad was granted both religious and political control. By the year 630, Muhammad and his army had grown to such power and influence, they were able to return to Mecca and take control without even a struggle. Upon entering Mecca, Muhammad destroyed all of the idols, and within 1 year was able to unify all of the tribes of the Arabian Peninsula under the religion of Islam. 2 years later, on June 8th, 632, Muhammad died. Now, after the death of Muhammad, Muslims faced something of a division as to who would lead it. And essentially, the Islamic faith divided into two groups, the Sunnis and the Shiite. The Sunnis believe that Muhammad's successor should be elected. The Shiites believe that Muhammad's successor should come through Muhammad's bloodline. Well, the Sunnis got their way, at least in the sense of the popular vote. They are now the largest branch of the Muslim faith. Of the nearly 2 billion Muslims in the world, about 1.5 billion are Sunnis. But the Shiite get the most press because while they number only around 250 million or so, they are very authority-oriented. They believe that their religious leaders should exercise both religious and political control and power. So with a country like the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is a Shiite Muslim nation, the president of Iran is subject to the supreme leader of Iran, and the supreme leader is the Grand Ayatollah. Many of the fundamentalist or radical movements within Islam are made up of Shiite Muslims who wish to bring revolution to areas that they feel are oppressed spiritually or politically by non-Muslim ideologies or governments. But even with that understanding, you can't paint this with too broad of a brush. For example, the Taliban that you hear so much about in Afghanistan, as well as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is better known as ISIS, are not Shiite Muslim, they're radical Sunni Muslims. And so Sunni Muslims can be radicalized just as much as Shiite. There's also a mystical third wing of Islam called Sufism. There's several other minor Muslim sects, such as the Druze Muslims in Lebanon, Syria, northern Israel. You also have here in America the Nation of Islam. But it's the Sunnis and the Shiite who dominate. And of those two, the world's Muslims are overwhelmingly Sunni. Now, Islam spread after the death of Muhammad, spread throughout the world in rapid fashion. And the way they spread largely was due to military power, military expeditions, jihads. Within 12 years after Muhammad's death, this strategy resulted in the occupation of Egypt, the occupation of Syria, the occupation of Iraq. Now, at that time, people were not forced to become Muslims, and the people who were conquered were, on the most part, you know, treated well. But the fact that the country was controlled by Muslims and ordered under Islamic law, non-Muslims were also clearly second-class citizens under that leadership. So that led many to eventually feel forced to accept the faith. Well, that's a quick view of its history. Now let's get into its beliefs. This is very important to understand that the Islamic faith is built around five beliefs and it's built around five practices. So let me walk you through both sets very quickly. First, the five beliefs, which are also known as the five doctrines. The first and most essential doctrine of Islam is that God is one and that there is no other God but Allah, and nothing and no one else is to be associated with God. The second belief is that there are a hierarchy of angels with the angel Gabriel at the very top of the pecking order. According to Islam, every person who has ever existed has two angels assigned to them, one to record all of their good deeds, one to record all of their bad deeds. And there are also bad angels called jinn, from which we get our word genie. The third major belief is that God has sent a prophet to every nation to preach the message of there being only one God, including such biblical characters as Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses and David and Solomon and Jonah and John the Baptist and Jesus. Each was given for a particular age. Muhammad, however, is the last and the greatest of the prophets, and the only prophet who is for all time. Fourth major Islamic belief is that four of the highest-ranking prophets were given books of divine revelation, or scriptures. And those four are Moses, who was given the first five books of the Bible, David, who was given the Psalms, Jesus, who was given the Gospel, and then Muhammad, who was given the Quran. But only the Quran is considered to have been preserved in an uncorrupted state, and has existed eternally, they say, in Arabic, in heaven. The final major belief is that the God of the Quran has declared that there will be a day when we will all stand before him in judgment. And on that day, each person's deeds will be weighed in the balance. And those who have their good deeds outweigh their bad will be rewarded with paradise. And if your bad outweigh the good, then you will go to hell. Only God, which knows which ways our scales will tip, and no one knows until that final day of judgment. There's no way of knowing before whether or not you'll be accepted by God. Now, coupled with those five beliefs are the five practices of the Islamic faith, also known as the five pillars. The first practice or pillar has to do with reciting the Shahada. Shahada simply means to be witness. And when you recite it, what you actually say is, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his prophet. In fact, saying the Shahada with sincerity is all that it takes to become a Muslim. The second practice is to pray. Muslims are required to say 17 cycles of prayer every day. Those cycles are usually spread out over five times of prayer through the day at dawn, noon, mid-afternoon, dusk, and then 2 hours after sunset. You have to wash yourself in a prescribed way before praying, and when you pray, you are supposed to face yourself physically toward Mecca. Now, the only time that they're required to gather together is at noon on Fridays at their local mosque. The third practice is to engage in an annual fast. In remembrance of Muhammad receiving the Quran during the ninth lunar month of Ramadan, Muslims are expected to fast during the daylight hours of that month. Now, that month changes from year to year because Muslims follow a lunar calendar. During the fast, they cannot eat, drink, smoke, or engage in sexual relations. The fourth practice or pillar is to give alms. They're to give a certain percentage of their income to the poor and the needy. And the final belief is you have to make the pilgrimage. You have to make what's called the Hajj, and it's a very specific pilgrimage. Every Muslim must make a trip to Mecca at least once during their lifetime, provided they're able to physically and financially. Once there, they visit the sacred sites associated with the beginnings of the Islam faith. They perform a number of personal rituals, including mass animal sacrifices. And even though limited by Saudi authorities to 0.1% of the Muslim population from any given country, over 2 million people gather on an annual basis. It is the world's largest attended religious event. Now, some Muslims add a sixth practice, which is the jihad, or holy war. In essence, the jihad is a personal war you wage against yourself in terms of submission. It has to do with mental or spiritual striving, but it can also include actual war for the sake of the Islamic faith against others. And if you die in the course of a jihad, called the jihad of the sword or a holy war, you go straight to paradise. This has given rise to a dark side of Islam, condemned by most Muslims, but which did lead to such events as 9/11 and continues to motivate terrorism and acts of violence and war around the globe. More on that in a minute. So how does Islam differ from Christianity? There's so much in common. Some people wonder, well, is the father of Jesus the God of Muhammad? Is it kind of like just one kind of thing? Well, based on what we've already covered, if you know much about the Christian faith, there is a lot of common ground between Christians and Muslims. Islam is a noble faith with a deep belief in one God and high standards of morality and spiritual commitment and personal sacrifice. They share with Christians a belief in the sacredness of some of the same scriptures. They join with Christians in believing that there will come a time of resurrection, judgment, and heaven and hell. But once you leave those areas, you come across significant differences that are worth noting, having to do with the nature of God and the nature of Jesus and the nature of salvation and so much more. Let me give you five big tension points. First, Christians agree with Muslims that there is one and only one God, but they maintain that the scriptures teach that his oneness is a composite unity, or what is commonly known as a trinity. In other words, that one God is made up of three persons. That does not mean that there are three gods or that there is the belief in more than one God. It's just that the nature of the one God is triune. You have God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. Three persons who are one God. It's not like 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. It's more like 1 × 1 × 1 = 1. When the Bible records Jesus referring to God as his Father and to himself as his Son, it was not talking about a physical connection. He was claiming to have a very special relationship with God that referred to his identity and their equality. To be the son of someone, in the sense that Jesus used the word, was to be of the same order as that person, to have the same qualities as that person. And the people of his day and his culture understood this completely. For example, when Jesus once healed a man on the Sabbath who had been an invalid for 38 years, he upset the religious leaders because healing was considered work and you were not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And when they confronted him about healing on the Sabbath, this is what Jesus said to them, and then the Bible's comment on how it impacted them. Jesus said to them, "Well, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So when Jesus said in John 10:30, "I and the Father are one," Christians accept it. Muslims do not. which leads to a second big distinction between Islam and Christianity, the nature of Jesus. Christians believe that Jesus was a lot more than just a prophet. As just saying, they believe that, I mean, we believe that he was God himself in human form, come to planet Earth, the second person of the Trinity, who came to be provide the ultimate manifestation of God and his truth to the world and to die for our sins on the cross. Muslims hold Jesus in high regard, but they don't believe that he was anything more than a prophet, and not even the greatest prophet at that, because that position would belong to Muhammad. They believe that through the Quran, God broke into history through the written word. Christians believe that through Jesus, God broke into human history through the word made flesh to give the clearest, most comprehensive picture of himself possible. Well, the third big distinction between Christianity and Islam has to do with this nature of salvation. How do you get right with God? How are you saved? Christians believe we do not earn our way to heaven. We do not work our way to heaven. It is a gift that is offered to us through what Jesus did on the cross. Muslims believe, no, you've got to earn it. You've got to work your way to heaven. There are two angels counting up every good deed and bad deed, and you better hope that the count comes out in your favor. There is no free gift flowing from Jesus or anybody else. They believe, in fact, that it would be an insult for one of God's prophets, even if he wasn't the greatest one, to even die such a death as on the cross. That's why they believe Jesus didn't really die on the cross. I don't know if you knew this. They think that something happened, that he was caught up into heaven and someone else took his place on the cross, because they can't believe that a prophet would die that way. Christians believe, no, the death of Jesus happened, and it was purposeful. And it mattered because it was in our place. He loved each one of us so much that he gave his life for ours. And such an act is not shameful. It's something beautiful. It's not something that would dishonor a prophet of God. It was the greatest single act of love in all of human history. Or as Paul wrote in Philippians, he said, Jesus, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name. We don't also have to wonder, as a result, if we're good enough to make it, if we're good enough to get in. Because when it comes time to have our life weighed and examined in the scales, it's not going to be our life that's ultimately examined. It's going to be the life of Jesus. His life will be substituted for ours. It's as if when the books are opened, everything that we've done will be blotted out, and under our name will be everything Christ did. You see, the heart of the Christian message is that we're not saved on the basis of what we do. We're saved on the basis of what has been done for us. Well, let me get into a fourth tension point, and it has to do with violence. Two very different views on violence. There is a myth, and it is a myth, that when it comes to violence and bloodshed, the Bible and the Quran are on equal footing. That there's no real difference between the violence committed in the name of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS than the violence committed in the name of Christ. That there's no real difference between modern-day jihads and the Crusades of the Middle Ages. Friends, it's simply not true. The difference between Christianity and Islam when it comes to violence is profound. Let's begin with the Quran and let it speak for itself. While most Muslims condemn the violent acts of Islamic terrorists, the Quran itself unmistakably has many troublesome passages. There's just no way to get around it. There's no other way to put it. When it comes to justifying violence in the name of the Islamic faith, it's not like the terrorists are making this up. They're getting this from somewhere, and they're getting it from the Quran. For example, in the second chapter of the Quran, there's a passage that teaches that whenever believers meet unbelievers, Muslims are encouraged to smite their neck. That's not simply in the second chapter of the Quran, it's in the ninth chapter, and it's also in the 47th chapter. Islamic tradition approves of violence against infidels and those who leave Islam as their native or chosen religion. And even to this day, we hear news reports of, it's like someone becoming a Christian or converting in an Islamic country, and they're charged with blasphemy and executed. Fighting and killing are described as beloved activities. And as I mentioned earlier in the Quran, it's actually in the 47th chapter as well, if you die in the course of this kind of jihad as a martyr, you go straight to paradise. Let me just read this. The Quran says, when you encounter those who disbelieve, strike at their necks. Then when you have routed them, bind them firmly. Had God willed, he could have defeated them himself, but he thus tests some of you by means of others. As for those who are killed in the way of God, he will not let their deeds go to waste. He will guide them and will improve their state of mind and will admit them into paradise, which he has identified for them. And then this quote attributed directly to Muhammad. The sword is the key of heaven and hell. A drop of blood shed in the cause of Allah, a night spent in arms, is of more avail than 2 months of fasting or prayer. Whoever falls in battle, his sins are forgiven. And at the day of judgment, his limbs shall be supplied by the wings of angels and cherubim. Friends, when you have that kind of rhetoric, coupled with that kind of reward, you're going to get some takers. And that's what we've seen around this planet. And all it takes for that kind of jihad to take place is for a Muslim leader to issue a fatwa, which is a legal ruling by a man in high standing in Islam, that someone is in violation of Islamic principles and should be punished by faithful Muslims. And there have been jihads not only called for against individuals, but against entire nations. And this is exactly what Osama bin Laden did. Prior to 9/11, he issued a fatwa. And let me read to you verbatim what that fatwa said. The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies, civilians and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. And Muslim extremists from Bangladesh, Egypt, and Palestine all signed that fatwa, titling it Urging Jihad Against Americans. Bin Laden went on to tell an ABC News producer that he would kill his own children if it were necessary to hit American targets. So while Islam itself implies peace, as Muslims will quickly tell you, the Quran itself contains clarion calls to violence. When Islam is opposed, the Quran states, and again I quote, fight them, meaning the non-believers, so that Allah may punish them at your hands and put them to shame. Now, you might be saying, okay, what about Christianity? Doesn't the Bible have its share of violence and bloodshed in its pages? And the answer is absolutely yes. It records without any sense of trying to protect the individual parties involved, punishments and sacrifices and wars and all kinds of things. It is not just simply a PG-13 book. It is often R-rated at many points and would be rated it for violence. We did an entire series on this actually called The Bloody Bible, where I walked us through the most clear acts of bloodshed in the Bible and what was up with that. And one of the things that we found in that series, through all of those historical recordings, is that what the Bible was mostly marked by, what God was mostly marked by, was mercy and restraint. And it was always just actions at play. And when men and women took it upon themselves to do something unjustly in God's name, it was always condemned. Always. Let me read you what Kenneth Woodward wrote about this in a Newsweek report on whether Christianity and Islam are cut from the same bolt of cloth on these matters. I thought it was a very interesting thing. He says, the Bible too has its stories of violence, but these stories do not have the force of divine commands. Moreover, Israeli commandos do not cite the Hebrew prophet Joshua as they go into battle the way Muslim insurgents readily invoke the example of their prophet, Muhammad. And while the Crusaders may have fought with the cross on their shields, they did not, could not, cite words from Jesus to justify their slaughters. And even the Crusades, as terrible as much of what happened under the banner may have been, it really needs to be put into its historical context. And, I don't talk about this much because I want to say it so that, you know, I'm not making this up. The bulk of my postdoctoral work at Oxford in England was on the Middle Ages. And I did a special concentrated study on the Crusades. And let me tell you something, there's been more revisionist history written of late about the Crusades. It's just, from a scholarship standpoint, it's just incredible. Let me give you a quick little thing about the Crusades. They began because of Islamic military attacks. They were instigated by Islamic military aggression and expansion. Jerusalem was forced to surrender to a Muslim army in the year 638. They immediately began construction, the Muslims did, of a mosque on Temple Mount, no less, the most offensive thing they could have done to the Jews and the Christians that lived there. By the year 711, they controlled all of North Africa. By the year 846, they were already attacking the outer areas of Rome, which was followed by horrific persecution of Christians. and appeals for help began to go to the Pope, who was considered the primary leader and protector of Christians around the world at that time. And appeals were coming in saying, please come help us. Please come save us. We're being slaughtered, and all of Christian civilization is being threatened. And so all of that began in 636. The first crusade was announced by Pope Urban in the year 1095. It had been going on for that many years with Christians showing restraint. And then by 1099, Christians did recapture Jerusalem, and that began this back and forth type of, you know, power struggle. It was back under Islamic rule by the year 1291, and it would stay that way until the end of the First World War. And without a doubt, there was atrocities done in the process by both parties. But painting the Crusades as if it was just a bunch of militant Christians with a bloodlust who decided to go off and kind of have a slaughter kegger for fun is not what happened. At the time, both Islamic and Christian historians said it was just part of the back and forth between Islam and Christianity, and particularly Islam making attacks and Christianity having to defend itself militarily. Well, one more divide between Christianity and Islam that also explains why there's so much hostility from some Muslims around the world toward America and other Western nations. So we'll use this as kind of a jumping off point to kind of put the wider cultural moment in context. And that divide is over Jerusalem. Jerusalem cannot help but be a flashpoint. It's at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because both groups consider it their capital. It contains Judaism's holiest site, Islam's third holiest site, and what is arguably Christianity's holiest site. For Jews, as we talked about last week, Jerusalem is the site of the temple, which was built at the site where the great patriarch of the Old Testament, Abraham, was to sacrifice his son Isaac. It was destroyed and then rebuilt again on the sacred ground of Abraham. The Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, is the surviving remnant of that second temple and is Judaism's most holy site. And as I showed last week, here's what it looks like, and you can visit it to this day. To Christians, Jerusalem is the site where the Last Supper took place, as you heard Zach talking about earlier, and then the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. The church on the Holy Sepulchre, of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, is said to be built on the site where those events took place, and the church surrounds it. And recent archaeological work, if you keep up with that, has gone a long way to confirming that this really is the site of Golgotha, this really is the site of the tomb where Jesus was laid. And that's what the word sepulcher means, a small room cut into a rock where a dead person is laid. And this is what the Church of the Holy Sepulcher looks like from the outside today. And you can go inside that church and you can actually reach out and touch the rock of Golgotha where the cross was. You can enter the tomb where Jesus was laid. Jerusalem is also sacred to Muslims because Muhammad is said to have ascended to heaven from the stone that is now enclosed by the Dome of the Rock on Jerusalem's Temple Mount. And here's what it looks like to this day. The mosque there is considered the third holiest mosque in the Muslim world after the ones at Mecca and Medina. And that's why it's kind of ironic that Jerusalem, though, is one of the safest places you can visit in the world, because you have all three, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, with vested interest in making sure that nothing happens there, nothing happens to these places, because they're holy sites. Now, why does all this, though, cause hostility toward nations like America? The main reason is because America has historically supported Israel, the nation who is seen as keeping the area out of Muslim control. Thus, America, in the eyes of some Muslims, has declared war on Allah himself. But that's just part of what's going on, because this isn't really simply about a place. And this is what may be helpful to understand the wider cultural context. This is about a goal. And this really does lie at the heart and soul of Islam. Muslims believe that humans are born good, but they're corrupted by non-Islamic cultures. Now, in the Christian faith, we see all humans as born in sin, and we all face the same sin struggle. And our problem isn't a culture as much as it is our heart. For Muslims, the problem isn't sin as much as it is living in a culture and a society and under a government that doesn't follow Islamic law. So the way to battle the corruption is to put everything and everyone under Islamic law. According to Islamic beliefs, the best hope of salvation for a Muslim is the elimination of non-Muslim influences and to advance Islam in a socio-political way. And America and the West is, without a doubt, the biggest cultural barrier to that happening on this planet. In fact, we're seen as a decadent culture, and we are a decadent culture in many ways, but they would say everything about it is alien and needs to be replaced. This was how Islam initially spread throughout the world under Muhammad. It was through military expeditions. It was through jihads. And now that element within Islam is flashing up all over the world. In fact, it's been said that Islam is the only true world's faith that can be called political. You know, it's the only faith that really is political in its nature. There's an interesting book on this that came out before 9/11. And it's now being seen by many scholars as just prescient in its forecast. It was written by a Harvard professor named Samuel Huntington, and it was called The Clash of Civilizations. And his thesis at the time was that there are three great civilizations operating in our world. There is Eastern religion, which involves the Asian Rim. There is Islam, which involves 30-some-odd countries stretching from, you know, Indonesia in the east all the way to Nigeria in the west. And there's Western liberal democracy, as framed and formed by the Judeo-Christian tradition. Those are the three great civilizations. Huntington says that the 21st century will be shaped by the clash of those civilizations, and particularly between Islam and the West. And obviously, he's been proven right. But he went further. He predicted that if things don't change, Islam will win the day. And the reason, he says, is simple. There are Muslims who will pick up the sword to do it. Christians won't. So the difference between Christianity and Islam are stark. And it's those differences, though, that lie at the heart of Christianity's appeal. Even to Muslims, there was a fascinating study conducted between 1991 and 2007 by Fuller's School of Intercultural Studies. They conducted a survey of 750 Muslims who converted to the Christian faith. And they represented 50 ethnic groups, 30 different countries. They were trying to get at, what was it about Christianity that was so appealing to you? And it was everything we've talked about today. They cited things like, you know, the idea of grace, the idea of love, that with Christians, it appeared you have loving marriages, you know, where women are not treated as slaves but as equals, that the Quran has produced profound disillusionment because it accentuates God's punishment more than his love, and the use of violence to impose Islamic law, that Muslims can never be certain of their own forgiveness and salvation the way Christians can. They were so attracted to this idea of unconditional love, God's loving coming to us free of charge, no strings attached. To many in the Muslim world, those are ideas that were just like rain on dry ground, very dry ground. And that's the way it should have felt, because it's what makes these two faiths so completely, radically different from each other. Okay, well, let's stand for a closing prayer. That was a lot fast, but I'm not going to let up. Next week, we're going to jump right into the next big question, and I think you're going to find it really intriguing. Next week, we're going to talk about what is the difference between Protestants and Catholics. So we're going to tackle that one head on. All right? I think you're going to want to be here. Let me pray. Father, I want to pray for the Muslim people of the world, that they would see you for who you truly are, your character, your heart, your love, your mercy, your compassion. I want to pray that they would come to see that the prophet they honor, Jesus, was much more than a prophet, and how he brought a message of love and peace to this world. And not just for the world in general, but for them as individuals. And I pray that in the name of Jesus. Amen.